Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
We live in a curious biological world. We've profiled a lot of interesting specimens on this show over the years, and today we want to talk about animal sexual fluidity and general the general fluidity of sex and gender itself in the animal kingdom.
Yeah, because we can't help but sort of take our humanness and just project it onto other organisms out there. So when we talk about gender bending, so to speak, in the animal world, what are we talking about? We're not just talking about sharing parental duties. So I'm talking about the seahorse.
Yes.
It's not enough to carry up to 1,500 eggs in your marine animal version of a baby Bjorn to be considered someone who is gender switching. So we are going to talk specifically about animals that change their sex and why they do it. And while we're talking about this, why not talk about the sex change chicken?
Oh, yes. You're talking about Gertie the hen, who later became Bertie, B-E-R-T-I-E, Bertie instead of Gertie.
This was the rooster.
The rooster, yes. This is in 2011, where you had a pair of British chicken farmers, and they observed a spontaneous gender change in their previously egg-laying hen, Gertie. So she began to walk around like a rooster, put on weight, developed wattles under her chin, and she also grew dark brown plumage and a scarlet coxcomb on top of her head.
Yeah, and she began to crow. the British couple said that at first the crow was terrible, but with practice, she actually sounded like a rooster. And according to Remy Molina, writing for Live Science, what happens with birds is that you have two sex organs present during the embryonic stages. But once a chicken's female genes kick in, it typically develops only the left ovary. The right gonad, which is yet to be defined as an ovary or testes or both, is called the ovotestis, remains dormant. So the idea here is that something like an ovarian cyst, a tumor, or maybe even a diseased adrenal gland caused the ovary to shut down in Gertie, and then the dormant ovotestis kicked in and produced androgens, which are hormones that are associated with male characteristics, which would have led to Gertie's, but then Bertie's physical and behavioral changes. And this is more of an example of a loophole in sexual dimorphism. But we're really going to talk more about organisms that are intentionally switching this up as a survival tactic or even a response to environmental conditions.
Yeah, situations where sex switching, is about the long game of survival.
Now, there are a couple of types of sex switching. The first is simultaneous hermaphrodites, and they have both female and male reproductive parts for their entire life, and they can mate with any other member of their species they should find. We're talking about more like fish and gastropods.
Slugs, to call back to our slug sex episode.
Yes, that make up the bulk of this type.
And then you have sequential hermaphrodites, and sequential hermaphrodites are born as one sex, but change completely into the other sex during the course of their lives. So this is definitely the more engaging for human eyes example of sex changing, because it's one where an animal is actually transitioning from one gender into another and sometimes back again.
So the question is, why doesn't it occur more, especially if you consider that this kind of strategy would double your chances for a Saturday night, so to speak? Because you'd have, you know, from these strategies, a large number of offspring. So Suzanne Alonzo, assistant professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at Yale University, says, quote, "An intuitive yet rarely studied explanation is that the considerable time or energy it takes to change sex make hermaphroditism unfeasible for most animals." That was the idea that she went into when she and her team created this theoretical model of hermaphrodite and separate sex life histories. And in their game, or rather the model, sex change players, I put players in quotes, vary the age of their sex change while the separate sex strategy responds by altering the number of male and female offspring it produces. And they found that a hermaphrodite could spend 30% of its lifetime in the process of changing sex and yet still persist in a population. And so what that suggests is that only huge changes, or cost rather, can disfavor sex change.
Hmm.
So 30% is not really enough to be of concern to limit that species' lifespan. They can still exist while doing this. If it were more up to 50% of their time, 70% of their time and energy changing into another sex, then it might become an issue. And so Alonzo and the researchers say that just taken alone, that this cannot be the only reason why it's rare in nature. And maybe it's more about the environmental conditions, which are generally more balanced. So you don't have to worry so much about there being too many females or too many males.
Okay. So it's when the environment is out of balance, that's when something has to change.
Yeah. And she also said for some species, parental duties might affect this as well. So it might be more advantageous just to have the separate sex system in place.
Okay. All right, so this leads us to the area of gender performance. Now, this is obviously a situation where a male is not changing into a female is not changing into a male, but sometimes there is an advantage in pretending that you are a member of the opposite gender. One wonderful example of this occurs with cuttlefish. So you have a two-tiered system of males with cuttlefish. You have big brash brawlers, and then you have smaller stealthy Lotharios. And the footage of these encounters between the males, particularly in the larger cuttlefish species, not the cute small ones, the little iridescent ones that you see at so many aquariums, but I'm talking about the big Cthulhu-esque ones. They get into these big tearing fights with each other, like ripping tentacles apart, just really brawling all over the rights to the female cuttlefish that are sort of waiting in the wings there. So on the surface of things, this might seem like it would just really favor the big brash brawlers, while the stealthy Lotharios would be on the outskirts, right? How are they going to get in there? Well, so what they do is they use the cuttlefish powers of shape changing and color changing, particularly by use of their chromatophores, to look like a female, to sort of draw in, change their color a bit, and then they can move in. They move in closer to the female, and then the big brawler guy that's over here hanging out, he looks over and he's like, oh, that's just another female getting close to the female that I want. Maybe I'll mate with both of them, so I'm not going to do anything, right? But meanwhile, the little guy is getting closer and closer so that he can breed, and often does successfully breed, with the female cuttlefish. And so just clever is this disguise, and so perfect the use of their chromatophores. A 2012 study out of Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia, found that males can actually split themselves down the middle, appearing to be a male on one side of their body and a female on the other. So he's floating here between the big brawler and the female. And to the big brawler, it looks like a lady cuttlefish just floating there harmless. But on the other side, he's flirting and gaming to mate with the female.
I like that. It's kind of like having your own split billboard.
Yeah, indeed.
All right. Now, the female market squid does a similar thing. What she does is she flashes a pair of fake testes. This is really interesting because the life of a female market squid is not an easy one. You have hundreds of thousands of market squids gathering to reproduce with really aggressive behavior from the males, which often causes injuries. And female squids, they will lay tubes of their eggs on the seafloor. And that's all good and well, except that a lot of times above them will be a big ball of sort of breeding ball in the ocean going on. And so it's really easy for them to kind of get sucked back into that breeding ball. And again, it's very violent. It takes up a lot of their energy and their resources, and they have just laid these tubes of eggs on the floor. So what do they do to try to counteract this? Well, they use a little subterfuge. They control the appearance of this white stripe down the part of their body that mimics the approximate size, color, and position of testes on a male squid. So the male sees this and thinks, oh, not female, leave alone. Mm-hmm. She gets off scot-free. And according to Daniel DeMartini, one of the co-authors of a study on female market fish, so we've seen the chromatophores, right? The chromatophores. Mm-hmm. Those sort of specialized pigment cells and that ability to change coloring, right? But
right.
we have never seen before the ability to turn white on and off.
Huh.
And this is due to a specialized type of cell called a leucophore.
So she's essentially, it's like when the taxi sign goes in service, out of service.
Well, yeah, with, you know, just testes as the symbol, I suppose.
All right. Well, that brings us to the world of garter snakes. Now, I want everyone to imagine themselves in Manitoba, Canada for a minute. All right. The snow is melted. Spring is setting in. And that's when tens of thousands of red-sided garter snakes emerge from their limestone dens and begin to engage in great tangled mating rituals. We're talking Roman orgies of serpentine sex performed right out in the open, right there on the limestone.
Roman orgies.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just big.
It's Caligula.
Big, yeah, Caligula balls of snakes going at it, right there in front of God and everybody. Afterwards, after all is said and done, now they end up sliding off into the local marshes for the summer, carry about their life, and then they return to their dens in early fall. Now, generally speaking, in each of these big clustered balls of snakes, there's a female at the center, because the males are competing for the mating rights there. That's what's going on in this big tangle. But in some cases, the males actually mimic females to wind up at the center of the heap.
Sly.
Yeah. Now you might wonder, well, why would a male snake do that? Well, think again about the fact that they're doing this. They're having this big snake orgy out in the open. So birds of prey are well aware that this occurs because this is an all-you-can-eat snake buffet. Just come down to, you know, talons and beaks ablazing and just eat as much as you want. So there is a survival advantage in being at the center of that heap, because you're going to be far harder to get to. There's far less possibility that these birds of prey are going to feed on you. So maybe this male snake, he doesn't have an actual shot at reproductive success in a tangle, but if he pretends to be a female, he can at least get a survival advantage and get to snake off into the marshes.
So all plots in nature lead back to bosom buddies, is
yes.
what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're talking about females imitating males imitating females.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure this was in one of Shakespeare's dramedies, but I don't remember which one.
I'm sure. I'm sure that Shakespeare looked at the African bat bug, which is a small reddish-brown parasite that feeds off bat blood. Take that, bats. And probably penned a couple of stories based on them. These bat bugs practice something called traumatic insemination. We've talked about this before. It's when males stab females in the abdomen with needle-like penises, and they inject sperm directly into the bloodstream.
Ugh.
And, yeah, right, it's pretty violent. It's hard on the females. And it's also hard on other males, because sometimes males do it to other males. And so this may be more of a combat thing. So to protect themselves, the female bat bug develops something called paragenitals. We're talking about a funnel-like genital opening on their body that tricks the male bat bug into sticking, you know, the needle-like penis into this area that is filled with immune cells. So it's really a smart strategy by the female bat bugs, because what it does is it reduces the site of injury to this one location, and it's guiding the probe straight into a bucket of immune cells, and that helps to reduce the impact of injury. Now, male bat bugs took notice of this, and this is where the males who are imitating females comes in, and created a similar paragenital to redirect attacks on their bodies, except that the paragenitals made them look more like females.
Oh.
So, right, oops. So they adopted a differently shaped funnel, which is more open and exposed, and that greatly reduced attacks. So now you have females noticing that the males have done this and made this adaptation, and they also adopt the differently shaped funnel. And Claus Reinhardt of the University of Sheffield, UK, who led a study on this, says that both of these female and male bat bugs who made these further adaptations, they suffered fewer mating scars than those with standard closed forms.
Huh. So we see just this arms race between the genders in these African bat bugs.
Right. So then the question becomes, well, do they just keep creating these iterations of paragenitalia until they become ridiculous looking?
Becomes, I mean, I guess there has to be a point where the wave kind of breaks and falls back, right? Because at some point, it would not be sustainable. So there'd be like a level of complexity that it couldn't go beyond, right?
So yeah, that brings up the question about what form will they ultimately take?
Now, another wonderful example of this time of pseudogender is female spotted hyena. And this is pretty remarkable because female spotted hyenas are the socially dominant, larger, and more aggressive of their species. And they have a pseudopenis. Now, to be clear, what they have here is an enlarged clitoris that can actually achieve a 7-inch erection, as well as a structure that looks like a scrotum, a pseudoscrotum that's formed from the labia. And this makes them the only female mammalian species devoid of an external vaginal opening. And that's why we used to think, well, that they might be hermaphrodites, that these were either hermaphrodite individuals in the species or that the species itself featured hermaphrodites. There are a lot of mysteries that remain about like what purpose this actually serves for the spotted hyenas, but on a biological basis, it's all due to higher levels of the hormone androgen in the females, particularly the pack dominant females. So it gives them their greater sizes, the greater strength, but it also makes reproduction difficult. So there are basically three areas where we see the wages of this. First of all, it creates an awkward mounting situation for males and females.
But I'm sure that clitoris is getting in the way.
Yeah. In fact, it's to the point they say that the males like really have to learn how to do it. Like there, some species they just take to it like a horse to water. But with the spotted hyena, the male is going to have to get in a little practice before he can actually connect. Also, there's some difficult plumbing here when it comes to the birth of the pups, because they have to give birth through this pseudopenis. So on one level, you're talking about a narrow birth canal. It's an inch in diameter, and the tissue often tears as a 2-pound pup squeezes through. And that rip can actually prove fatal. So that means that there's a higher mortality rate for first-time spotted hyena mothers. Additionally, the umbilical cord is a bit on the short side compared to the length of the birth tube. So the cord often breaks before the cub emerges, and this can lead to death for the young cub. In fact, 60% of hyena cubs die of suffocation inside the pseudopenis.
Wow. So another example of this that we've had on this show many times, I feel like I need to say, and come out to the stage again, once again, and join us, Brazilian cave insects. Because in the May 2014 edition of Current Biology, Yoshizawa Kazunuro et al., they documented their findings from when they dissected 4 species of cave-dwelling winged insects from Brazil, called Neotrogla. And they realized when they dissected them that the females had an internal penis-like structure that they likely only extended during mating, and the males had a pouch-like vagina. And so, okay, what are the mechanisms of this? Well, during mating, the female's spiny penis gets tightly anchored to the male's male vagina's sperm duct, allowing the female to receive the semen. So in other words, the penis functions more like a straw than a spout. And if the male tries to break away, the abdomen would, well, rip open and he would lose his genitals there. The female insects also mate with multiple males, and they can store 2 batches of sperm in the body. All right. What they think, the researchers think, is that it could be the environmental conditions that have created this sort of penis-like structure in the female cave insects. That's because there is a lot of competition among males for fertile females. And in the cave environment, food is scarce. And so it turns out that the male's sperm is seen as a nuptial gift, because not only can the female cave spider transfer this to her eggs, but before she does so, she can actually eat some of it, and it has nutritional value. So you see here that that's why the female is taking the role here as the aggressor in the reproductive relationship and essentially scooping out that sperm with this penis-like structure.
All right, that brings us to the area of gender change, outright gender change. And we see this particularly in three different fish species, which serve as wonderful examples. The first of which is the anemone fish, a.k.a. the clownfish. And if you're a parent, a.k.a. the Nemo fish, these are some of the most prominent examples of sequential hermaphrodites. They live in a mutualistic relationship with a single anemone for most of their lives. And this is, of course, the the small aquatic organism with the stinging tendrils, right? But the anemone fish are have an immunity to that sting, so it's a wonderful, safe place to live. But they're also kind of isolationist here, okay? So in this anemone neighborhood, you have a sole female and the largest male, and those are the ones doing all the mating. But when the female dies, the largest fish in the anemone neighborhood becomes a female, and then she begins mating with the next male. So you have a huge advantage to reproduction in this. You get additional genetic diversity because every fish in the immediate environment is a potential mate. But it's also particularly good since, again, we're talking about a secluded little neighborhood, a secluded environment. They don't stray from far from home. So if you need that diversity, if you need a new female, you just make one from the population.
Another example of this is the parrotfish, which is common around tropical reefs throughout the world. And one of the adaptations that makes them unique and really interesting is that they have pharyngeal teeth, which you can use to grind up corals, or they use to grind up corals.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is that at night, they surround themselves in this mucus-like cocoon to protect them while they sleep. And the idea is that the cocoon could mask their scent and making them harder for nocturnal predators like moray eels to find. But, of course, the super interesting thing about them is that they can change sex in response to fluctuations in population density. So they have two strategies when it comes to this. In the first strategy, they're all born female, and then later they can change sex into males. And they can also begin life as males, second strategy, known as primary males.
Hmm.
And it's thought, again, that this sex change is in response to low population density in one or the other of the genders. So, in parrotfish populations, the large supermales, these are large males that were once female, are dominant, and they claim most of the females. And the primary males often spawn in groups with one female. So starting out as a female and then changing sex later would be really advantageous. Females don't have any trouble finding mates, no matter how large they are, while the males are much more reproductively successful as larger individuals. So they can reproduce as females when they're younger, and then when they grow to a large enough size to compete as males, they change sex and reproduce as super males.
Now you see a similar situation with hawkfish. Now hawkfish are another tropical coral-dwelling fish, and in the wild they have been observed to participate in what we call bidirectional sex change. So they're going from female to male, but then also back again. So it's a similar situation with the parrotfish. Functional females changing into males if a dominant super male dies, but they can change back.
Ah, so they're multidirectional when it comes to that.
Yeah, multidirectional. You can think of it in terms of, there's an opening on the staff. This individual can transition into that role for a little bit, but then when they're no longer needed there, back into their previous role.
And this reminds me of that whole concept of survival as a whole, as a species, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not just about the individual fish here. It's looking at the whole population and responding accordingly and making sure that, yes, we can respond to that and change and offspring and its corresponding genetic packages can be furthered into the future.
Yeah. It's like we need a male to survive. We need a female to survive. Who's going to step up and change? And then you have a fish that comes up and does the job. And then the genetic lineage can continue.
Now, we wanted to leave off this episode with this really cool butterfly that was discovered at the Natural History Museum of London in 2011. It's a Mormon butterfly. It hatched, and the staff noticed, hey, the coloring looks a bit off on this. And they looked closer, and they discovered that it was almost black on its male side, all black.
Mm-hmm.
And on the female side, it was paler and flecked with blue, red, and tortoiseshell. And of course, at first they didn't realize that this was half female, half male butterfly, because really you only see that in circus sideshows, right?
Yeah, I mean, their sex organs were essentially welded together. It you would think this is like a Fiji mermaid kind of a thing, right? Where come see the half man, half woman butterfly, right?
Yeah, they had one antenna was actually smaller than the others, and as you say, the reproductive organs were fused together. And this is actually something called gynandromorphy.
Hmm.
Happens from time to time.
Yeah, so it serves as kind of an interesting symbol, I think, of the fluidity of sex and gender that in butterflies, but in just any organism, it's not so fixed an issue.
It isn't. And it's, again, it's a response to environmental conditions. Mm. It's somewhat of a question of energy resources, survival. And we wanted to point out, too, that we have an episode called Can Animals Be Gay that explores more of the behavior of animals. We want to make a distinction between what we're talking about today and this idea that animals behave in a way that seems gay, I'm putting that in quotes, to yeah. us.
Yeah, when you bring in the human baggage of trying to figure out how animals work, yeah. So indeed, yeah, check out that episode if you like. We'll make sure that we link to that on the landing page for this episode at stufftoblowyourmind.com. You know, we have a few minutes here. Let's call over the robot and have a little listener mail. All right, this one comes to us from Porter. Porter writes in and says, "Hi, I'm the digital director at the U.S. Fund for UNICEF and also an avid Stuff to Blow Your Mind listener. I've been working all weekend trying to raise funds for the Nepal earthquake relief effort. And I was listening to Stuff to Blow Your Mind episodes early Monday, and when what do I hear? During the Power of Polite episode, Julie mentioned donating to UNICEF is a nice thing to do, while explaining the off-record indirect politeness strategy. I can't tell you how happy that made me. Donating to UNICEF is a nice thing to do. Hey, also, restaurants, maybe there should be a National Pizza Day where you give 10% of your profits to UNICEF. If you can mention our Nepal donate form on the podcast, I'd be really grateful. Thanks for all the great episodes over the years. That's unicefusa.org/Nepal. That's unicefusa.org/Nepal.
Thanks, Porter. And yeah, guys, make sure to check that out. If that has been on your mind, that would be a great thing to contribute to. We also have a bit of correspondence here from Caroline. This was a Facebook message that she sent us. She said, "I just listened to your episode about politeness and I thought it was so great. When you were leading up to the most impolite society, I literally shouted, 'Eastern Europeans!' I laugh because I'm a first generation American whose parents are Polish. I spent much of my life in Poland and the United States, and I can appreciate the direct attitude that Polish people have. It can be very abrasive to anyone from outside the culture. If I go to Poland for a few weeks at a time, I definitely begin to miss the friendliness of Americans, but I know a lot of my American friends perceive me as very direct. In Poland, it's certainly no big deal for someone at a bus stop to tell a complete stranger that their kid is being too loud. That would never happen here." No, she's right, it wouldn't. "I get the unique experience of having both personality traits. You did also make a great point about familiarity in Eastern European culture. If you're a stranger, you will be looked at with suspicion, but if you are in the inner circle, you are among some of the kindest, loving people. We wouldn't greet a stranger with kisses, but your closest friends and family definitely get 3 cheek kisses. I love that you totally hit the nail on the head with this episode. Keep up the great work, Caroline.
All right, so there you have it. Hey, if you want to check out more episodes, including that Can Animals Be Gay episode that we referenced earlier, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That is the mothership. That's where you'll find all of our podcast episodes, videos, blogs, you name it.
And if you have some thoughts on animal sexual fluidity and you want to send them to us, we can do so by emailing us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.